Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This podcast episode was made possible in part with support from Sacred Rights, a project funded by the Henry Luce Foundation and the E. Rhodes and Leona B. Carpenter Foundation and hosted by Northeastern University. Sacred Rights is a project that supports public scholarship on religion and provides resources and networks for scholars of religion committed to translating the significance of their research to a broader audience. I recommend you learn more about Sacred Rights on their website at sacred-rights.org or find Sacred Rights on Twitter at sacred_rights. Welcome to Classical Ideas. This is Greg Soden. This is a podcast where, since 2017, I have discussed all things religion with a variety of fantastic scholars, historians, journalists, and educators. On this episode, I am delighted to welcome Dr. Elise Ambrose. Dr. L. Ambrose is a Black queer ethicist, creative, and educator. Their book, A Black Queer Sexual Ethics, Embodiment, Possibility, and Living Archive from T.N.T. Clark, offers a trans-religious and communal-based sexual ethics grounded in Black Queer Archive. Ambrose's photosonic exhibition, Spirit in the Dark Body, Black Queer Expressions of the Immaterial, explores Black queer and trans spiritualities and identity. Ambrose is currently assistant professor in the Departments for the Study of Religion and of Black Studies at the University of California, Riverside, and has featured their commentary in the Huffington Post, Vice, Be More Art, and CBC Radio 1's Tapestry podcast. On this episode, we discuss the Photosonic Exhibition Project and the book, A Black Queer Sexual Ethics, Embodiment, Possibility, and Living Archive. Thank you so much for listening. Dr. Elise Ambrose, welcome to Classical Ideas.
Thank you so much, Greg. I'm glad to be here.
I'm delighted that you're here. I'm wondering if we can start off by having you introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners out there so they know a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Sure thing. So I'm Elise Ambrose. I also go by L, pronouns they, them. And I'm a Black queer ethicist, a creative, and an educator living with my partner and our parakeets in Los Angeles, California.
I want to know a little bit about your backstory as well. I know you did your PhD at Drew University, and I know you are, currently in the University of California at Riverside, correct?
Yes, I am. Excellent. There in two departments, the Department of Black Study, the new Department of Black Study, and the Department for the Study of Religion. So, you know, twice the department, twice the fun, twice the meetings, all the goodness.
Wonderful. Well, I want to hear a little bit about your academic trajectory. I want to know sort of your path along the way that sort of led you to becoming an ethicist. Tell me about some of the major turning points along your academic and intellectual journey.
I'll say that my education started, my higher ed started at Howard University, where I got my BBA, Bachelor of Business Administration. And I'm not sure how I shifted from business administration to a Master of Divinity, but it was a lot of, I think, personal growth and just some questions around how I wanted to make an impact in the world, or how I felt led to be making an impact in the world. And thinking about the communities that I was encountering, I lived in Washington, D.C. while I was at Howard. And though I was born in New Orleans and raised outside of New Orleans, I saw a lot of things in D.C. that I had never seen before, as it related to economic disparity, as it related to racial concerns, gentrification, things of that nature. And so my world was expanded so much when my college career had come to an end. And so in that sort of space of self-reflection and self-discovery, and even spiritual and religious discovery, I found myself at another historically Black institution, Gammon Seminary, at the Interdenominational Theological Center in Atlanta, Georgia. And there I worked with one of the founders of womanist theology, Jacqueline Grant, as well as a Hebrew Bible professor by the name of Randall C. Bailey. And I just want to give a shout out to both of them for introducing to me a liberative engagement with theology, with ethics, with sacred texts, and being two of the extraordinary professors that helped me to get where I am today, and really encouraged me to apply for a PhD and to get it in religion and society, which I did at Drew. I'll say while I was at Drew earning my PhD, I was also serving as an associate pastor at a church in Greenwich Village in New York City. Mm-hmm. So that gave me an opportunity to practice a lot of what I was thinking. And you know, my book is on sexual ethics, and also on communal ethics in a lot of ways. And so that environment of the village of I was living not far from Harlem at the time, and so much was percolating to get me to the creation of this book personally and professionally and mentally, emotionally, spiritually, religious, everything just converging. So it's a lot of paths coming together that bring us here now.
There's one question I have before we get into the book that I want to know a little bit about. I was reading your bio and I saw that you did a photosonic exhibition called Spirit in the Dark Body, Black Queer Expressions of the Immaterial. And I want to know a little bit about this project first before we dive into the book, because that title really caught my eye and I just wanted to hear a little bit about it.
Yeah, thank you for that. I'll begin by saying that project was one of the most meaningful engagements with art community and myself that I've ever had. So I thank all of those people who were a part of the first iteration as well as the second iteration of that project. And it's featured in part in my book. But that project arose because I was trapped in my left brain while I was working on my dissertation, if that's right, left brain, the really like rational side, and felt stuck because I didn't know how to move forward with my dissertation project. I had come to kind of a standstill, and maybe more so, more than a standstill, I would say it was burnout. And so I needed to activate the right side of my brain and also just, you know, get back to my why, the community, my community that really moves me to do this work. And so I felt like seeing them getting out of my room, getting out of in front of my computer, seeing them, sharing space with them, hearing their stories would do something to encourage and inspire me, because I was absolutely dry. And also, these stories matter. And I felt like because I was dealing with archive and thinking about futures and all of those sorts of things, it felt important to have a record. As Gordon Parks, he's a renowned Black photographer, says he talks about setting the record straight pictorially. And I sort of put a spin on that because I don't want to set the record straight. I kind of want to queer the record, but have a record of Black, queer, and trans life and thriving. And so that's where this project was born. And so it consisted of me interviewing in total about 15 Black, queer, and trans practitioners of spirituality or the religious in some respect, and recording their stories, photographing them. And in the end, I ended up doing some sound work, sort of splicing their voices together and creating a soundscape around the photography as well. So I was able to show that at the American Academy of Religion in 2019, and really proud of that work, really proud of it.
That's fantastic. And I'm looking at the table of contents here in the book, and this is chapter 3 of the book, isn't it?
It's a spin on it. Yeah. So I added some new interviews, wanted to get more trans voices in. So like, I'd say a little bit less than half of the people in the book now I identify under the trans umbrella, Black trans umbrella. Yeah, parts of those interviews, I'll tell you, they went on. We kikied, we had a great time. So I had to cut it to make it appropriate for the book. But yeah, I wanted to have their voices within the book, not edited, not really used to serve the ends of my book of a Black queer sexual ethics, but their immediate voices that I think, you know, people would hear, particularly Black queer people would hear or read and be moved by it in some fashion, or at least know that these stories exist.
Wonderful. Well, let's dive into the book a little bit more. It's called A Black Queer Sexual Ethics, Embodiment, Possibility, and Living Archive. So the book I'm reading as a description is, the book is a trans-religious and communal-based sexual ethics grounded in Black queer archive. And I'm wondering if you can go into a little bit of the terminology here within the title. I want to know about, you know, the terminology Black queer, but I also want to know about the terminology for archive that you're talking about in the title. So if you go into those two terms for me, that'd be amazing.
Sure. So Black queer, I'll say for the people who aren't able to see it, Black queer is one word. Mm-hmm. And I'm inspired there by my colleague, Ashawn Crawley, as well as others who want to speak to the inability to disentangle Blackness with queerness, particularly when we're thinking about not only Black queer as a positionality, but Black queer as a politic. And so I put those two words together to signal that inseparability in terms of the politic, but also in terms of the embodiment, that a Black queer person, as we're thinking about Black queerness as it is lived in bodies, those two terms are not exclusive in any way, though some takes on religion would have us believe that queerness is always antithetical to the religious in some way. So I bring the Black queer with the religious in that respect, but also those who would say that Blackness and queerness are antithetical, I bring them together as one word to counter that sort of idea, but also because my lived experience tells me so. In terms of archive, I use the term living archive, which some other scholars have employed it as well, but as I utilize it in this book, I'm thinking of living archive as that which is malleable, that which is, as I have said in some other settings, an archive that may be as far as Schlesinger Library over at Harvard University and as near as your the person next to you, the story that resides within them, even as near as that room that is in your grandmother's house that mm-hmm. you're not allowed to go into, that has plastic everywhere. At least that's my grandmother's house.
Yeah.
Out to Bashery, Louisiana. As near as that, or as far as, right, some of these ivory towers and things of that nature, but want to trouble the category of archive by making it living, malleable, taken away to, added from, having within it not just the stories of extraordinary individuals of the past, but radical and revolutionary communities of now. Mm-hmm. And so the archive is living in that it is porous, it is messy, to refer to Manalan San, right? Talking about queer archives and things of that nature. But for the most part, I want to point to that flexibility and the willingness to always return to, take away from, add to wherever it serves community and liberative ends.
You know, I want to know a little bit about your interest in sexual ethics as well. I've talked a little bit about sexual ethics in regards to religion on this show. Rebecca Epstein Levy was on the show a few years back, and we talked a lot about that within the context of Judaism. Tell me a little bit about your interest and work within sexual ethics.
So my interest in sexual ethics, I'll say, was enlivened during my period of being a pastor and a Christian pastor. And while I no longer hold those affiliations, a lot of the stories and experiences I had on my path to ordination, the people I met, the theologies that were embedded that I, as a quote unquote progressive pastor, had to contend with, like all of that continues to inform my work today, those experiences and people. I frequently encountered people, despite our progressive preaching, our progressive message, our, you know, liberative and cutting edge interpretations of the Bible, they still, some queer people I encountered still struggled with reconciling their faith and their queerness. Mm. And on one level, I had to deal with the question of feeling somewhat ineffective as far as the methods that we were employing, attempting to assist people in their faith journey. But on another hand, I think I was sitting more with the question of, are the resources that we have available accomplishing what we say that we're trying to do? And so it's not just enough to say, in my opinion, you know, God loves you. As a Black queer person, that wasn't enough for me. It took me really doing my dissertation on sexual ethics and writing this book to come to a full circle understanding of who I am in relationship to the sacred. This work was really my effort to add a tool to the toolbox of materials that could be used, referred to, employed by folks who are trying to come to a usable sexual ethics, one that is anti-racist, one that is not anti-body, as so many ethics, particularly Christian traditionalism, has led us in this direction, right? These types of sexual ethics that have been so limiting to human flourishing, this is my attempt to add something to the toolbox of flourishing. It is merely that, an effort, and I'm most excited about how communities can engage with it and find what's useful and, you know, talk to me about what's not.
Yeah, well, let's dive in a little bit more to a couple chapters. We already kind of talked about spirit and the dark body a bit, but let's go to chapter one here. It's called Examining the Integrative in Black Queer Harlem. I'd love to know about your interest in Harlem and a little bit about what this chapter is about for listeners to sort of preview.
So when I was living in New York, I was living on the Upper West Side. So again, not far from Harlem. And something about Harlem, when you really, you know, integrate with the community, you go to the events that are held, the cultural events, you not so much as a tourist, but as someone who is invested in the well-being of the community in some way, you can get swept up in Harlem. It's an extraordinary place. And so part of my areas of study when I was earning my PhD also involved African-American studies. In engaging African-American studies, African-American histories, I think I just became acquainted, of course, with Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes and others, County Cullen. These have been, I went to Howard University. So these figures have been in my life for some time. But living near the places where they partied, where they would connect with one another and build this intellectual community, this, interdependent sort of community, right? They're not only the literati of the Harlem Renaissance, they're also integral members of a community in Harlem. And so when I'm talking about Black queer Harlem, as I call it, I'm not necessarily only framing the people of Harlem as Black queer, right? Again, talking about positionality, but their politic as subversive, themselves as a counterpublic to the larger Harlem community, as well as to the New York community that didn't create space for their wholeness as far as gender and sexuality and even race and economics, right? And so I look to three communities there, the Hamilton Lodge Ball, the rent parties, and the blues environments. And so within sort of a Black liberationist tradition, I'm returning to the blues women and the environments they were able to create through the subversiveness of their music, the way that they dealt with issues of sexual expansiveness, gender expansiveness, even while some of the more elite members of the community would consider the blues to be sort of a lower cultural form. Here they are creating community for people to be in their bodies, to move and sway in freedom, and to even be a little, as I say again, a little bit messy, a little bit wild with some of the subject matter, but expressive, to say the least. I'm thinking of the words of Angela Davis, right, who in her book on these blues women, she's saying how for the first time, Black people, really a new generation of Black people who are able to claim their bodies for themselves, and able to claim a kind of autonomy that was not available to Black people throughout history, while, those who are in the United States. And so this sort of claiming and the unique space that Harlem is for that kind of claiming was absolutely moving, inspiring for me. And being able to actually visit and be in the space, go to the Schomburg, see some of the settings that, were associated with Alalia Walker or Madam C.J. Walker's daughter and some of her really extraordinary parties that she would throw, right? Being able to see these spaces face to face, I think really invigorated the project and made me excited about how I can tell a different kind of story of Harlem. Not that people haven't heard about the Black queerness of 1920s Harlem, but that to see it as a place of moral, ethical fecundity, I think is to tell the story another way, and to borrow from Emily Towns there. And so I was really excited to be able to do that, to tell the story of Black queer Harlem another way.
What I want to know is, like, for this book, what was, like, some of your biggest challenges about the whole entire research process? Like, when you put yourself back in that time space of putting the book together and bringing the research together, what stands out to you as, like, some of the hardest things that you had to overcome to get this book written? Was it a natural process? Like, did it really come together well? Like, what was interesting and fun about the process?
I feel what was particularly moving about the early part of the process of the inception stage, I would say, and even getting, like, introduction and things together in the previous iteration of this project, which was my dissertation, was being willing to open myself enough to realize that this project, as I mentioned before, was an exploration of my own questions. Of course, there's something very intriguing intellectually about all that I've taken up, to me at least. And there's something that is very interesting and, could help me to move forward in my career in whatever kind of ways, right? But really, it's a personal journey. And so sitting with my own questions, opening myself up to exploration in order to even get to the place where I can put pen to paper or finger to keyboard or what have you. All of that was very personal in my own journey. And so this book is a representation of my struggling with religion, struggling with spirituality, struggling with where are the examples of usable and helpful sexual ethics. How has the conversation within theology and ethics either lended itself to liberative processes and ends for Black queer people, or how has it hindered that? And what can actually be a helpful contribution to a decades-long conversation? And so where I eventually landed was on this notion that sexual ethics are communal ethics, that this focus on sex acts is quite limiting mm-hmm. and destructive if we aren't able to get at the deeper questions, related to justice, related to right relationship, related to how are we toward one another, not necessarily what are the particular do's and don'ts that we are ascribing to or practicing in the quote unquote correct way. And what's more important, and I think that the archive affirms this, as well as a sort of a trans-religious approach to the study of ethics, affirms that what matters is right relating, how communities relate to one another, how individuals relate to one another. And if we can use that as a helpful starting place for thinking about communal ethics or sexual ethics and sexual ethics, then I think that we can get to an ethic that works for communities and that serves collective well-being.
Excellent. Well, I am really excited about this book, Black Queer Sexual Ethics, Embodiment, Possibility, and Living Archive from T&T Clark, coming out in June of 2024. Very exciting. Congratulations. The end of a book process has got to feel like such a catharsis to bring something like this into the world. I'm sure you are just bursting with excitement.
I really am, and I believe I will totally burst when I'm holding the book in my hand.
Yeah. Well, let's chat a little bit about something else. Let's talk about public scholarship a little bit, because you are a very engaged public scholar. I was looking through some of the places that your work has been featured in: Huffington Post, Vice, Be More Art, CBC Radio 1's Tapestry podcast. Tell me a little bit about getting yourself out there into the public sphere as far as like commentary and writing and being a part of the dialogue beyond the ivory tower, so to speak.
Sure, Greg. You know, I have always tried to hold myself to a standard of having in mind my communities of accountability with all of the work that I do academically. And it feels odd to attempt to do that work without being connected to community and without being able to reach people who are not in academia. You know, I'm greatly informed by Black feminist and womanist praxis, and they both show me the significance of scholarship, not only for scholarship's sake, but scholarship that really has liberative potential. And in order for it to have liberative potential, it has to be connected, I would argue, with the communities that are at the center of the work and have communities in mind as the work is being crafted. And so because I am connected in community and that's very significant to me, I make efforts to ensure that things I write or even places I speak are not only these quote unquote ivory towers, but that they are places where people can access the information for free or be in dialogue with me about what's taking place or what's being said, or, you know, raise questions and always frame my work as something that is a part of a larger conversation that's not only academic, but a part of the work that artists and activists and everyday community people have been contributing to bring us toward a more just society. And so To me, if I'm accountable to my community, and I do desire to be, I have to be in sort of in this public sphere and bring those stories with me in every place that I go.
Wonderful. Well, I know that you are involved in a cohort of public scholarship training led by Dr. Liz Bukar. What did you get out of that process of going through the public scholarship development with Sacred Rights?
Well, it was a lot of fun.
Oh, good.
A lot of fun in some unexpected ways, particularly being able to connect with Dr. Bukar and my colleagues and seeing the ways that they are employing their public scholarship, right? The creative ways that they're doing at the communities they're connected with and the ways that they're translating sometimes some very complex things into language that works for accessibility, right? And so I learned so much about the significance of being in community with people who are also on a path of public scholarship and wanting to do that translation work, and also the importance of employing multiple methods, multiple paths to sharing this work. And so, you know, though I am a millennial, I am not super social media savvy, but there were other folks who were like doing TikTok and things of that nature. And I'm like, you know, go off, good for you. And then, you know, there's folks who are, you know, writing these statements with members of their organizations, their non-government organizations, people who are, you know, writing for journals that have access to everyday people, writing for magazines, all of these things. And so it really opened my mind to other possibilities that I could explore, you know, see a fine example of people that I know by name doing it and feel like not so afraid to step out into those waters.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. L. Ambrose, I am delighted by this conversation. Once again, congratulations so much on the book, A Black Queer Sexual Ethics Embodiment, Possibility, and Living Archive. What a fantastic way to spend an afternoon. Thank you so much for coming on Classical Ideas and chatting with me about your forthcoming work and some of the stuff that you've put out there in the world, like the Photosonic exhibit, Spirit in the Dark Body, and some of your other public scholarship. It's been just a real pleasure having you on the podcast and being able to chat about some stuff that I've never really gotten to talk about before on the show. It means a lot.
Well, thank you so much, Greg. I really appreciate the invitation and all the thoughtfulness that went into your questions. And it was just really a delight to be with you as well.